Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph, and we are today in lesson 149, the last lesson, the last verses that we covered were about the Philistines, the king of the Philistines, Abimelech, and Pichol, his chief of staff, and their ceremony of swearing and a covenant between them and Abraham. And we mentioned the fact that these Philistines came from a certain place, and it would be interesting to know where they came from, since God is involved in so many of these details, and there is an awful lot of background behind everything that God does and the people that come in contact with the people of God. And when God takes the time to mention certain people or their genealogy or other details, obviously he wants us to know a little bit more about them and why God brought them into that place. With the Philistine, Plishtim in Hebrew, and later on became Philistine, you know, the M turned into an N instead of Plishtim with an M, it turned into a Plishtim. That is, in later languages, obviously not in Hebrew, that's still the same. And then as time went by, obviously it became something totally different, like the Palestinians today. Basically all from the same name. Now, we wanted to know, where did they come from? Why are they there? And the relationship they had with Abraham. And after that, they're going to have a relationship with Isaac. And of course, with Jacob later on, and then all the people of Israel, as they came back to the land, they had a relationship with them too. And obviously, most of the time, it was not a good one. In this case, still with the fathers, the relationship is different, in contrast to what it became later on. And then to this very day, we see a relationship with them that on an individual basis, when you go to the land of Israel today, to Israel, you see that on an individual basis, they may have some good relationship with some of them, but nationally speaking, it hasn't been good in the past several decades. And so you want to know, where did these Philistines come from? Let's go to Genesis chapter 10, where we read about their background. In Genesis chapter 10, at that point, God is speaking about many other nations, where they descended from, where they came from. And so the Philistines obviously are also among them. And in chapter 10 and verse 6, we read, the sons of Ham, now Ham was one of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japheth actually, or Yefet in Hebrew, Yefet meaning comes from Yofi, which means beautiful. I guess he was good looking. And so they call him Yefet. And Ham in Hebrew, not Ham. Ham, you know, you lose the meaning, you don't know what it means. But when you say Ham in Hebrew, you know what it means. It means hot. Maybe that's why they ended up in the hot areas of the world. You don't find them in cold areas, generally speaking. Unless some of them on an individual basis migrated to colder areas, but generally they like to be in warm places. Hot. So this is what he called him, hot. Ham, that is. And Ham, you know, later on. Since the people that migrated from this area began to lose their ability to sound those guttural letters, and Ha is one of them. You still find it in among the Mexicans or the Spanish. They say Juanita, you know, Ha. Now, only they write it with a J. I don't know why. But in either case, this Ham had different children, and his children were Cush. It's not Kash, as I say in English. Kash means straw. And Cush, obviously is a name, it's not Cush. And Mizraim, and from that comes the land of Egypt. Egypt in Hebrew is Mizraim. And then Put and Canaan. Now, then we read about Mizraim, we're interested in him because he's the one that, he's the forefather of the Philistines. And so in verses 13 to 14, we read more about this Mizraim. In verse 13, we read, Mitzrayim begat Ludim, Anamim, Lehavim, Naphtulim, Patrusim, and Kasluhim. That means they had seven children. And from whom? From these children came the Philistines and Kaphtorim. It's interesting, Kaphtor in Hebrew means, well, later on in letter language anyway, it means button. You know, like the buttons you have on a shirt. Why were they given that name? I don't know. But Kaphtorim in the ancient Hebrew language, of course, it's not used in the same way today, was for decorations, you know, like flowers that he put on garments and clothes. And so, since those flowers were sort of round or, you know, had a shape that reminds people of the button, you know, that he used later on history of men, and so in Hebrew they gave it the same name, Kaphtorim. Anyway, that was the Philistines and the Kaphtorim came from Mitzrayim. And then, now all these are from Ham. And then we read about Canaan. Canaan begot Sidon and his firstborn Het, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite. And then a few more. In other words, all these people, well, the Canaanites, verse 18 also, the Arvites, the Zemorites, the Hamamites, and afterward the families of the Canaanites were dispersed, and the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, today in Lebanon, as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza, all the way down to Gaza. Then as you go toward Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Tzvoim, as far as Lasha, which were apparently closer to the coast. So we find all these Canaanites spread all around there in what became known as the land of Canaan. And these Philistines that came from some of the sons of Mitzrayim obviously originally were not there. They were in a different place. But they came there later on. And so it's interesting to see where they came from, because God tells us about it also. And so as we go further into the story of the people of Israel, Moses is adding some information about these people, and he's telling us where these people came from. And so in chapter 2, as he's describing the land of Israel, as the people of Israel are headed in that direction, this is what he tells the children of Israel in verse 23. Before that, he tells a story about the other nations that used to live in that area and how they were chased away by other people. And so he gives a sort of a background, what happened before the children of Israel came to their land. In other words, God was already beginning to get rid of some of the undesirable people that were there even before Israel migrated in that direction, and mainly the giants that were in several places. He brought other people to get rid of them. And this is what he's telling them. And then verse 23, he says, "And the Avim who dwelt in the villages as far as Gaza," people were called the Avim, "and the Kaphtorim," as we just mentioned before that, "who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and dwelt in their place." In other words, people came from Kaphtor, and when you look at the biblical map to find out where is Kaphtor, is basically Crete. So people came from Crete to this area, invaded that area, and they destroyed the former inhabitants of that place. But actually, all these people are basically from the children of Ham. So all in one way related. Of course, several generations down the road, talking about 500 years down the road, but nevertheless, they were all Hamitic people. And they came and destroyed them and took over that place. So now you find out where the Kaphtorim came from, and also the Philistine came from the same place. They too came from Kaphtor, in other words, from Crete. So the Philistines also had the same name as Kaphtorim, since they came from Kaphtor, but also they had that name also of Plishtim, and we'll find out how they acquired this name. Now, the word Plishtim in Hebrew means invaders. And so, obviously, when they came into that land and conquered that area, invaded that place, the inhabitants of the land gave them that name, Plishtim. And Moses refers to them sort of retroactively by what they were called later on. And then he tells us that they came from Kaftor. In other words, previously they were known as Kaftorim. And as they came, that is the part of them that came and migrated into that area for whatever reason, into the coast of Canaan, they became known as the invaders, in other words, the Plishtim, and their land was called Pleshet, the land of the invaders. And later on in history, that name was given to the entirety of the land by Rome, that is in 137 AD, when they conquered Judea, that is totally conquered Judea, because all the rebels that took over there, you know, the days of Bar Kokhba, and they wanted to totally blot out any memory of the Jews in the land, and also the name of the land itself. That the picked on the name of the people that were hated, most hated by the Jews for many, many centuries, and they gave the name of the land according to the name of those people. And so since that time on, obviously it took quite a while before people and historians began to refer to that land as Palestine, because for the longest time, the people who were, biblically oriented continued to call it the Holy Land, or Judea, or Samaria. But then the secular world picked up on that word and began to call it Palestine. So they should have known what is the original name of the place. And since they didn't have much reverence or appreciation of the biblical terminology, they didn't care much about using that, in essence, wrong terminology to the land. You know, Palestine. That doesn't mean that just because they call it Palestine, that now the Palestinians, you know, took over the whole land at that time. That was a gradual thing before they began spreading. And so that is one reason why they claim that that land belongs to them. You see, even the name of the land, they say it's called Palestine. It's not called Canaan. It's not called Israel. It's not called Judea or Samaria. So you can see what's happening from that point of view. And so we find out where the invaders, the Palestinians of that day, or the Plishtim, came from Crete. And then we go into the prophets, where God himself tells us why are these Philistines in that place. Who brought them over there? Who was responsible for it? And obviously he had a reason for it. And so we read not only about the Philistines or the Plishtim or the Palestinians, the modern Palestinians, but also we read about another people that God brought over there and placed them right on the border of his own people, the land of Israel. And when you realize the history of the people of Israel, their constant rebellion against God, and the need to constantly punish them, you will begin to understand why God brought these people to that territory. He used them, in essence, as whipping boys against his own people. And so in chapter 9 and verse 7, God is discussing the state of mind of his people. And so he says in verse 7, "Are you not like the people of Ethiopia to me?" In other words, you're not better than all those the people of Cush, the Cushites, or the Hamitic people. He said, "You're just like the people of Ethiopia, or the sons of Ethiopia to me." In other words, you're not better than they are in your conduct and your behavior. "O children of Israel," says the Eternal, "did I not bring Israel from the land of Egypt?" Egypt was the land of Ham, or Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim was the father of the Philistines. So he said, "Did I not bring Israel from the land of Mitzrayim?" Or Egypt, later on, that's in the Greek. They gave the name, you know, Egypt to that place. Ashka, you know, of the original name. And the name to this very day is Mitzrayim. The people, you know, in Egypt don't call themselves Egyptians. They call themselves Masri. Mitzrayim, they know where they came from. And of course, they have the ancient Egyptians and the modern Egyptians. And God says, did I not bring Israel from the land of Egypt, and the Philistines from Kaphtor, and the Syrians from Kir? So, he says, I'm the one responsible for it. I brought you from Egypt. I brought the Philistines from Kaphtor, where they were known originally as Kaphtorim, from Crete. In modern language, you say the Cretans. And later on, the Apostle Paul talked about the Cretans, you know, who were of a different nature, he said. Even their own prophets spoke about them. You know, the Cretans were lazy people, you know, big bellies, talk too much. In other words, troublemakers. And then he brought the Philistines from Kaphtor, from Crete, and the Syrians, the Arameans, Arame in Hebrew, Syria, that's a letter of terminology, which is a short of Assyria. And the reason for that is that the people of Assyria were left behind. They did not migrate. You know, the main body migrated into northwestern Europe, into modern Germany. But a part of them remained behind. They were called the White Syrians. And some of them are still there to this very day in Syria. And others went to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran. In other words, you still find the ancient ancestors of the modern Germany still in that area. And that's why oftentimes you see those links between these two nations. And you find them even in Iraq. Some of these Assyrians, later on called Syria. And so he brought the Syrians from Kir, and Kir is more toward Turkey, beyond the river. And so God is bringing these people into this configuration, where they are all together, and obviously he has a purpose for it. And when he studied the history of the time, and to this very day, as a matter of fact, you realize how God used these people oftentimes to spank his own nation. And when his people were obedient to God, they were on top. And these people were under them, oftentimes under tribute and subjugated. And the days of David, when God was with him, since he was with God, we read that he had garrisons in Damascus. He reigned over that area, which in essence, this area really belongs to Israel, including the land of the Philistines. God gave it to Israel. But because of Israel's chronic rebellion against God, God needed on hand, you know, those paddles, so to speak, you know, to spank his people now and then, you know, the whipping boys, and use them for that purpose, and still does to this very day. And only God says when Israel returns to him totally, wholeheartedly, only then he will deal with these people and put an end to their animosities against his own people. And so this is what he's saying about them. Now, in the Psalms, we read more about these people, where Asaph, one of the chief priests in the temple, and one of the chief musicians, and he was known, as a matter of fact, he had sort of a dynasty because he had many sons down the road, and they constantly composed music. And so many of the Psalms were composed actually by him. Some people don't realize that. They think everything was written by David. Yet Asaph wrote many psalms, and when you begin reading the psalm, notice the first introduction to it. It'll tell you who wrote it. You go to Psalm 74, 75, 76. As a matter of fact, when you begin from what is called the third book of the Psalms, 73 to 89, they're all written by Asaph. And so when you get to Psalm 83, this is what we read about the Palestinians, or the Philistines. In this psalm, psalm of Asaph, the chief musicians of the temple, a priest also, is in essence looking into the future and by divine inspiration, prophetically, speaking about the enemies of God, the enemies of Israel, in his day, in future time, and to this very moment, and what their intent is and what they want to do to the people of God. And so you read in Psalm 1, do not keep silent, O God, do not hold your peace, and do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies, You see, that's how they are presented. Even though God brought Assyria, that is Assyria, Aram, into that territory nearby on the border of Israel, and they oftentimes were enemies of Israel. Sometimes they were even allies of Israel, depending on how, you know, the northern kingdom had alliances with them, and other times even the southern kingdom made alliances with them. But most of the time they had a very, very tempestuous relationship between them. And so, though God brought them over there, they became enemies of Israel, obviously. And if Israel behaved herself, then they would not be enemies. And if they were, then God would deal with them as he did several times in the days of David and others. And so God is presenting them as inspiring Esau, as his enemies. That's what they are. That's how he regards them, even though he is the one that brought them over there to deal with his own people in their bad days. And so he says, "For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you." Now, these people don't think that way. You see? Especially as time went by and they began to know about the one God. And later on, they began to be a part of, gradually, of what became known as Islam. And they all think they worship Allah, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham. And yet, God says, "No, these people are my enemies." And one of these days, they're going to find out that they were. And why are they his enemies, even though he uses them as whipping boys? It's because, first, they do not obey themselves, and secondly, they oftentimes, with cruelty beyond that which God required, have afflicted his people. And so he says, "Your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones." Now he's going to mention several of them. And he said that was the way from the days of, the time that Israel entered into the land. Those animosities with the nations around them were always there, intensifying at times. And other times they were just quiet. But this is a prophecy to this very day, where Israel is going to find herself in that condition, even though they were away from the land for almost 1900 years as a nation. Though individually, many of them were still there. And so he said, this is what they say about your people. They have said in verse 4, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation." You see, that was a desire oftentimes of these enemies of Israel. And yet, in ancient time, in the biblical time, you don't see them really necessarily wanting to totally conquer the whole land. Just now and then, they would have frictions that generally stood in their own borders. Now and then, they would have forays into the land of Israel. But they did not want to cut Israel from being a nation. So this is more specifically about our end time, where the literally, nowadays, the enemies of Israel all around want to totally cut off Israel from being a nation. So it's more specifically about our day. And so it says, this is what they're saying, as they're getting together, consulting, creating confederacies now and there, and alliances, and they've done it from the time that the Jews had established the land, and before that, they totally wanted to cut them off from being a nation and destroy them. And they're at it all the time whenever they can. Even, with these so-called peace agreements, the total intent, ultimate intent, is all the way there. Total destruction of the nation, and the removal of, as they call it, those Zionists that occupy our land, when in essence they are the ones who occupy the land. They are the squatters. They are the Philistines. They are the invaders. And so this is what they say. "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more." Now, when Rome wanted to totally obliterate not only the Jews from that land, but even the memory of them and the name of the land, that's what they've done. You see, but he's not talking about Rome, even though later on, as we are going to go through this subject, when we get to the twin brother of Jacob, Edom, we'll have more to say about it. And then we'll come back to this one and illuminate more and give more information concerning this matter. But ultimately speaking, it's at the end time that there are people around the land of God who are, according to God, his enemies, who hate him. That's how he inspired Esau to write it. By divine inspiration, he's writing it. And their whole desire, and they seem to be consumed with him, they've been, you know, for the past many decades, with the utter destruction of his own people, which he obviously is not interested in the destruction. Now, he wants them to be punished, yes, but not destroyed, you see. So when he gives a commission to the enemy to come and spank his people, that enemy goes over and above and beyond and wants to totally destroy because of the hatred that is within them. And that's when God says, you go too far. And he will do the same also to Assyria at the end time as he did in the past, and also to Babylon. They went too far. You know, he said, I was a little angry, you know, for Isaiah. I was angry but a little, but they went beyond that. And so this is what their intent is, to totally blot out Israel from the map. And as a matter of fact, for the longest time, in Jordan, until recent times, when you went into their school system and looked into their geography books, you would always notice that they always, when you come to the map of Israel, they would always glue it together with another page so their kids, as they grow up, would never see the map of Israel, would never see the name. You know, that's how hateful they were. And that's not of God. And so, well, you know, literally they went that far. And so God is describing it long ago. We're talking about almost 3,000 years ago, that state of mind of today. But of course there were always animosities there, though they have never been this intense like they are today, where they want total destruction and occupation of the land, claiming that it is theirs. Now, that's in essence something new. And so in verse 5, for they have consulted together with one consent, they form a confederacy against you. And when the state of Israel was being established by decree from God at this end time, as well as in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, they at the same time also, these very people, and you can read about it in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, they wanted destroy what they thought was going to be a new Jewish state, and their temple, and their wall, and Jerusalem, the city, and all, and so forth. They were not interested in them being around. By now they've been around for a while, for about 70 years, when Judah was into captivity, and they thought, well, this is our land now, and you have no right being here. And so imagine when 19 centuries go by, how much more do they like to say that? And they feel that they are right. And so now he's giving the name of those people who are responsible for this attitude and that desire to totally obliterate the people of God. And so he says the tenth, verse 6, of Edom and the Ishmaelites. In other words, the number one player here is Edom, and as we come later on to this subject, you'll see it much more so. There is a lot of confusion there about this concept, about this idea, about this knowledge, about this background, and about the identity of Edom. Some people have totally gone astray with that, unfortunately, and an awful lot of people are believing this, which is totally untrue. The identity of Edom and the history behind it. There's unfortunately very little information there in the minds of many, even though history has plenty of information there, but people are blind, so they don't see it properly. Anyway, we'll come back to that later. But here, we're talking mainly about the Plishtim, the Philistines, Palestinians. And we're just giving the background here. And so in verse 6, the tents of Edom, number one, then the Ishmaelites, you see, people think that the main conflict there is Jacob, Ishmael, and God says, no, Edom is the number one problem there. And then the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites generally were not much of a problem until recent times. Now and then, you know, they may have little problems with them, but generally it was always Edom and others. And so the tents of Edom is number one, Ishmaelites, number two, Moab, that's Jordan, and today, and the Hagarites, which would be the children of Hagar. Apparently Hagar remarried, obviously she was still a young woman, she had a son, she needed a husband, So she had a son, she has a husband, and then, they spread. And so they were known as the Hagarites, children of Hagar. And they were east of the Jordan River, east of the Jordan River. And later on in Chronicles, you can read about them, where the children of Reuben defeated the Hagarites and took over the territory in the direction of Iraq. And so we find the Hagarites, number four, and then Gebal, which is Lebanon. And to this very day, you see those problems there with Lebanon, especially in recent times. And Ammon, again, modern-day Jordan. And Amalek, story by itself. And Philistia, or Pleshet, in Hebrew. Philistia, they wrote it in English, but it's Pleshet, with the inhabitants of Tyre. Now, you find Palestinians in Pleshet, that means the Gaza area, that generally dominated that area for many, many centuries. And to this day, they are there. There are over a million of them in the Gaza Strip. That is called the Gaza Strip. And here it is, right there in the land of Israel on the coast. And to this very day, they are sort of a thorn in the flesh of Israel, like a bone in their, in their mouth, in the throat, troublemakers, as they were in the days of old. And obviously, oftentimes because of the iniquities, unfortunately, of the people of God. And so you find them, the pleasure, the children, in other words, modern day, the Palestinians, and the inhabitants of Tyre. Now, in Tyre, to this very day, also, you find an awful lot of the Palestinians. In other words, many of them moved up in that direction after Israel was established. Obviously, many of them were chased away, and so they ended up in that area. And when you go to that direction of Tyre and Sidon and southern Lebanon and other parts of Lebanon, you find a lot of Palestinians there. And the Lebanese don't get along with them too well because, they consider them also as invaders. It's Plishtim in Hebrew. And so, obviously, to this very day, still are known as Palestinians, invaders. And, of course, they're not fully aware even of their own name, where it came from, what does it mean, and how God looks at it. And so, you have some background here about the Plishtim, that God is dealing with them. And the Philistines were, as I said earlier, from Mitzrayim, who was their forefathers. That means he was the son of Ham, while the Canaanites that were in the land were the part of the Kaphtorim that became known as the invaders, Plishtim. Invaded, they were relatives of them, but they were not a direct branch from the Canaanites, yet related to them, all from the same patriarch, Ham. And so, later on, all the branches that came from Canaan, God says to Israel, you are supposed to destroy them, totally obliterate them from under heaven. And yet he did not say that about the Philistines, even though they were in that very land, from the days of Abraham. And before that, they came, already invaded that. And when Abraham was there, that was already a reality that the Philistines were there. And they came earlier. I don't know exactly when. But God, mind you, when he told Israel to destroy all these nations that were in the land of Canaan, he did not mention the Plishtim. He did not mention the Philistines. Which is very interesting because he himself brought them over there. He inspired them, he put it in their heart to migrate in that direction. It's not just something, that they woke up one morning and said, let's go over there. So you can see how God does things. As he brought also the Arameans, later on called Syrians, into that very area from beyond the river of Euphrates. They had a role to play in the life of his own people that he was going to deal with. So long in advance, he prepared those things. And at the end of time, we're going to read in about Syria, in Isaiah 19, that God is going to mend the fences, and Israel, and you read there, Assyria, but you see Syria and Assyria are the same. And many of the, not the main body, but many of the Assyrians remain behind, and they are found in the land of Syria today. And that's why you find this different minorities. When you go to Syria, they are not all the same people. the people that took over, reign over the whole territory. They are a small minority. They are called the Shiites. And from that group comes Assad, Hafez al-Assad, that just died recently. And they are the ones that cruelly and ruthlessly, you know, rule over the nation. And the majority are not of the same people. They are the ones who are the modern Assyrians, descendants of the ancient Assyrians. And so when you read in Isaiah 19 about Assyria and Egypt and Israel as a triangle of nations who are now living at peace, that's what you're reading about. And some people, of course, not having a background, they think about Assyria in the ancient land, Germany. You know, they think about that. Yet Germany is in Western Europe, and there is not a link there between her and Egypt and Israel. But when you think about Syria, that was anciently Assyria, of whom some of the people are still descendants of the ancient Assyrians, then you begin to understand what you're reading there. And so we find that God is ultimately going to rid the whole land of all these foreigners, even though he brought them over there to the borders, and the ones that would remain behind would be peaceful with Israel. And so we read, we continue now. I think we had enough background here. We can always give much more, but this is not the intent to go very thoroughly through history. It's mainly the study of the law that we are interested in and certain aspects that are related to it. And so we ended up the story with Abraham in verse 33 now. Well, in verse 32, and so they made a covenant at Beersheba, that is the Philistines, Abimelech, that is the king and his chief of staff, and rose up and called the captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. They returned to Pleshet, or Eretz Plishtim. And that's where we gave the background, so you understand what's happening here, who are these people, who brought them over there, what would their future history be, and their link to this very day. So you see, the study of the law is not that boring, you know, when you consider all these matters. The law of God has an awful lot of elements in it. Some people think just legalism, and they become so narrow-minded they do not even want to open the book and study it, when, in effect, it includes every conceivable subject in the world that you can think of, in essence, that you can find in the book. You can talk about geography and history and chronology, you know, nations, peoples, laws, rules, regulations, agriculture, and psychology, everything is in it. That's the mind of God. And people are limiting the mind of God, have a narrow-minded attitude toward it, and therefore they have a resentment toward the law of God. They don't even know what it is. And so in verse 33 we continue, and Abraham planted a tamarisk tree, eshel in Hebrew. Later on, those things were called the groves. In other words, in those days, people didn't have big homes like you have today and halls and things like that for, you know, meeting together. And so they would plant those trees that would spread and provide shade, and they were used for several reasons. You can always relax under it, sit there at the heat of the day, and there you could have your own altar. As people in the old days, you know, they had altars everywhere. And so worship your God. And later on, the children of Israel who were commanded, you don't do it anymore. From now on, you come only to Jerusalem, and there you worship God. They still continue the same custom, because all the nations around them were still doing it. You know, you plant a big tree and grows up, and then you have a lot of shade, and then you can congregate your whole family there, and a lot of people, sometimes hundreds of people. When you have several trees like that, and they can all feel comfortable under those trees. And they had their celebrations, and they had all kind of things there. And so here it is, we see part of this custom, which at this point still allowed by God. He planted a tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord. In other words, he built an altar there, and he called on the name of Jehovah. As we mentioned earlier, several lessons before that, that Abraham knew the name of Jehovah. Even though later on we read something that we do not fully comprehend, unless we have the background, when God tells Moses later on in Exodus chapter 6, that I was known to the fathers by my name El Shaddai, but by my name Yehovah I was not known. And people who just read that scripture don't comprehend it. What God is, they can read what God is saying, but they don't know what he's meaning. You see, they don't understand it. Anyway, I'm not going to go through that again because I already explained it very thoroughly at that point. And so he's calling upon the name of Jehovah. And here we have another name of God, El Olam, the everlasting God. El is, you know, the singular for Elim. Eloha is a singular for Elohim. And so El, in either case, is God. In modern language, first in German, Gott, and then later on, G-O-D in English. So that stands for El. But El, or Elim, or Elohim, could be either false God or true gods. It's not by itself a holy name. Yehovah is a personal name. And so it's called here El Olam. Olam means world. El means God. God of the world, that means God that is here and today and forever. El Olam. And so in English it translated that to that, everlasting God. And Abraham journeyed or sojourned in the land of the Philistines many days. Now Abimelech was a good king. He was a decent man still, unlike those who came later on, and he told him, you can dwell here in the land as long as you want. And so in the land of the Philistines means that he dwelt along the coast where the Philistines, in the land of Pleshet, or the land of the Plishtim, were dwelling at the time, which means that he was along the coast. And the land of the Philistines didn't mean the whole land of Canaan, obviously. And so when he's in a certain territory, you know, the scripture will tell you that he's in a certain territory. In this case, he's in the territory of the Philistine, today the Gaza Strip. And so this is where he dwelt in peace, and for a long time. And shortly after that, we read in chapter 22. And it came to pass after these things that God did prove Abraham. He was going to put him to the test. He's not tempt, as you find in the King James, because tempted has a totally different connotation. But this was a trial, not a temptation. And so he proved him. That's where the word nisa, lenasot, to try, to test, nisayon, an experience, or to experiment. And so he was trying to test him to see what his heart is made of. And this was going to be the ultimate test for Abraham, and whether every single one of us is going to go through an ultimate test or just series of tests, well, that's up to God. And so he was testing him, and he said to him, and notice the language that he's going to use now, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son. You see, now Abraham at this point has two sons, but one of them was sent away. So now he has only one son that is with him. And he says, take now your son, your only son. See, the other one is gone. Now you have only one. And some people misunderstand that and they say, well, you see, this is what God is thinking about Ishmael. Ishmael is illegitimate. He doesn't consider him as a son of Abraham, which is foolish. He was his son, and God blessed him, and God had a relationship with him, and God spoke to his mother a couple of times, and he made him a great nation. He's the seed of Abraham. When he says, your only son, well, he's now the only one that is left with him. And so he says, your son, your only son, whom you love, even Isaac. So he's impressing that on him by the manner in which he's telling you that. And that becomes a very emotional matter, very powerful. And therefore, the test becomes even much more powerful. And so he says, you do all these things and you get you into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell you of. In other words, later on I'll tell you where it is. And so he is, in essence, fully awakening the emotions, you know, the passions of Abraham, his thoughts, his feelings, and his love toward his son, that greatest gift that he earlier gave him. This was a child of promise. And so he's taking the most important thing he ever gave to Abraham so far, in that sense, from his own body. And he said, the one that you set your heart on with all of your being and heart, you see, I want you to take him and offer him. And in essence, what you see there is, God is trying to, again, let Abraham know, and all of us, and we have to think about it in that way, that God is the one that should be the most important person in your life, that you should love the most, that you value the most. You see? That you are the most emotional about, and the most passionate in your love towards, and it's not your son. Even though I gave it to you, and you waited all of your life for this. So he's trying to make him understand the priorities. And many of us, even time, you know, sometimes God gives us a great blessing. Let's say if God give us a son, you know, if some people are barren, you know, they don't have children, then finally God gives them a child, and they love this child with their whole being and heart. They, you know, they'll lay down their life any time for that. And in the process, they forget who is number one in their life. You see, and that could be a mate, that could be a possession, that could be a land. You see, people become so patriotic about the land, they'll give their life for it, which is fine. And in the process, they begin to worship the land and forget about God who gave it. Anyway, we shall continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.